61. We got another possible break around midnight. The police had information about a house covered with a plastic material in Ottsville, Pennsylvania. Ottsville was about 30 miles away, and we drove there in several cars in the middle of the night. It was tough duty at the end of a long day, but nobody was complaining too much. When we arrived, the scene reminded me of my past life in D.C. Officers used to wait for me there, too. Three sedans and a couple of black vans were parked along the heavily wooded country road, around a bend from a dirt lane that led to the house. Ned Mahoney, who had just arrived from Washington, and I met up with the local sheriff, Eddie Lyle. "Lights are all out in the house," Mahoney observed as we approached what was actually a renovated log cabin. The only access to the secluded property was the dirt road. His HRT teams were waiting on his command to go. "It's past one," I said. "He might be waiting on us, though. I think there's something desperate about this guy." "Why's that?" Mahoney wanted to know. "I need to hear." He let her go. She saw his face and the house, the car, too. He must have known we'd find him here. "My people know what they're doing," the sheriff interrupted, sounding offended that he was being ignored. I didn't much care what he thought. I had seen a local, inexperienced rookie cop blown away in Virginia one time. "I know what I'm doing, too," the sheriff added. I stopped talking to Mahoney and stared at Lyle. "Hold it right here. We don't know what's waiting for us inside the house, but we do know this. He knew we'd find this place and come for him. Now you tell your men to stand down. FBI HRT goes in first. You're backup for us. Do you have a problem with that?" The sheriff's face reddened, and he thrust out his chin. "I sure as hell do. But it doesn't mean fuck all, does it?" "No, it doesn't matter at all. So tell your men to stand down. You stand down, too. I don't care how good you think you are." I started walking forward again with Mahoney, who was grinning and not trying to hide it. "You're a hot ticket, man," he said. A couple of his snipers were watching the cabin from less than 50 yards away. I could see that it had a gabled roof with a dormer on the loft level. Everything was dark inside. "This is HRT-1. Anything going on in there, Kilvert?" Mahoney said into his mic to one of the snipers.
"Not that I can see, sir. What's the take on the unsub?"
Mahoney looked at me. My eyes moved slowly across the cabin in the front and side yards. Everything looked neat, well maintained, and seemed to be in good repair. Power lines led to the roof. "He wanted us to come here, Ned. That can't be good."
"Booby trap?" he asked. "That's how we plan to proceed."
I nodded. "That's how I would go. If we're wrong, it'll give the locals some yucks."
"Fuck the local yokels," said Mahoney.
"I agree with that, now that I'm not a local anymore." "Hotel and Charlie teams, this is HRT-1, Mahoney said into his mic. "This is control. On the ready. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go." Two HRT teams of 7 rose up from phase line yellow, which is the final position for cover and concealment. They passed phase line green on the way to the house. After that, there was no turning back. HRT's motto for this kind of action was speed, surprise, and violence of action. They were very good at it, better than anything the Washington PD had to offer. Within a matter of seconds, the hotel and Charlie teams were inside the cottage where Audrey Meek had been kept captive for over a week. Then Mahoney and I burst through the back door and into the kitchen. I saw stove, refrigerator, cabinets, table. No art director. No resistance of any kind. Not yet. Mahoney and I moved ahead cautiously. The living room area had a wood-burning stove, a striped contemporary-style couch in beige and brown, several club chairs, a big chest covered by a dark green afghan. Everything was tasteful and organized. No art director. Canvases were everywhere. Most had been finished. Whoever had done the paintings was talented. "Secure," I heard. Then a shout, "In here!" Mahoney and I raced down a long hallway. Two of his men were already inside what looked to be the master bedroom. There were more painted canvases, lots of them, 50 or more. A nude body lay sprawled across the wooden floor. The look on the face was grotesque, tortured. The dead man's hands were tightly wrapped around his own throat, as if he were strangling himself. It was the man Audrey Meek had drawn for us. He was dead, and his death had been horrible. Most likely poison of some kind. Papers lay scattered on the bed. Alongside them, a fountain pen. I bent and began to read one of several notes.
To whomever. As you know by now, I am the one who held Audrey Meek captive. All I can say is that it is something I had to do. I believe I had no choice, no free will in the matter. I loved her since the first time I saw her at one of my exhibitions in Philadelphia. We talked that night, but of course she didn't remember me. No one ever does. Until now, anyway. What is the rationale behind an obsession? I have no idea, not a clue, even though I obsessed on Audrey for over 7 years of my life. I had all the money I would ever need, and yet it meant nothing to me. Not until I got the opportunity to take what I really wanted, what I needed. How could I resist, no matter the price? $250,000 seemed like nothing to be with Audrey, even for these few days. Then a strange thing, maybe a miracle. Once we spent time together, I found that I loved Audrey too much to keep her like this. I never harmed her. Not in my own mind, anyway. If I hurt you, Audrey, I'm sorry. I loved you very much. This much.
One sentence kept repeating inside my head after I finished reading. Not until I got the opportunity to take what I really wanted, what I needed. How had that happened? Who was out there fulfilling the fantasies of these madmen? Who was behind this? It sure wasn't the art director.
Part 3. Wolf Tracks. Chapter 52.
I didn't get back to Washington until almost 10 the following night. And I knew I was in trouble with Janie, probably with everybody in the house except little Alex and the cat. I'd promised we would go to the pool at the Y, and now it was too late to go anywhere, except to sleep. Nana was sitting over a cup of tea in the kitchen when I came in. She didn't even look up. I bypassed a lecture and headed upstairs in the hopes that Janie might still be awake. She was. My best little girl was sitting on her bed, surrounded by several magazines, including American Girl. Her old favorite bear, Theo, was propped in her lap. Janie had gone to sleep with Theo since she was less than a year old, and her mother was still alive. In one corner of the room, Rosie the cat was curled up on a pile of Janie's laundry. One of Nana's jobs for her and Damon was that they start doing their own laundry. I had a thought about Maria then. My wife was kind and courageous. A special woman who'd been shot in a mysterious drive-by incident in Southeast that I'd never been able to solve. I had never closed the file. Maybe something would turn up. It's been known to happen. I still missed her almost every day. Sometimes I even said a little prayer. I hope you forgive me, Maria. I'm doing the best I can. It just doesn't seem good enough sometimes. Good enough to me, anyway. We love you dearly. Janie must have sensed I was there, watching her, talking to her mother. I thought it was you, she said. Why is that? I asked. She shrugged. I just did. My sixth sense is working pretty good lately. Were you waiting up for me? I asked, as I slipped into her room. It had been our one guest bedroom. But last year we had converted it to Janie's. I had built the shelving for the clay menagerie from her Sojourner Truth period. A stegosaurus, a whale, a black squirrel, a panhandler, a witch tied to a stake, as well as her favorite books.
I wasn't waiting up, no. I didn't expect you home at all.
I sat down on the edge of the bed. Framed over it was a copy of a Magritte painting of a pipe with the caption, "This is not a pipe." "You're going to torture me some, huh?" I said.
"Of course. Goes without saying. I looked forward to some pool time all day."
"Fair enough." I put my hand on top of hers. "I'm sorry. I'm really sorry, Jenny."
"I know. You don't have to say that, actually. You don't have to be sorry. Really, you don't. I understand what you do is important. I get it. Even Damon does."
I squeezed my girl's hands in mine. She was so much like Maria. "Thank you, sweetie. I needed that tonight."
"I know," she whispered. "I could tell."
Chapter 53.
The Wolf was in Washington, D.C. on a business trip that night. He had a late dinner at the Ruth's Chris Steakhouse on Connecticut Avenue near DuPont Circle. Joining him was Franco Grimaldi, a stocky 38-year-old Italian capo from New York. They talked about a promising scheme to build Tahoe into a gambling mecca that would rival Vegas and Atlantic City. They also talked about Pro Hockey, the latest Vin Diesel movie, and a plan the Wolf had to make $1 billion on a single job. Then the Wolf said he had to leave. He had another meeting in Washington, business rather than pleasure. "You seeing the president?" Grimaldi asked. The Russian laughed. "No, he can't get anything done. He's all stronzati. Why should I see him? He should see me about Bin Laden and the terrorists. I get things done." "Tell me something," Grimaldi asked before the Wolf left. "The story about Palumbo out in the Max security prison in Colorado. You did that?" The Wolf shook his head. "A complete fairy tale. I am a businessman, not a lowlife, not some butcher. Don't believe everything you hear about me." The mafia head watched the unpredictable Russian leave the steakhouse, and he was almost certain the man had killed Palumbo, and also that the president ought to contact the Wolf about Al-Qaeda. Around midnight, the Wolf got out of a black Dodge Viper in Potomac Park. He could see the outline of an SUV across Ohio Drive. The roof light blinked on, and a single passenger got out. "Come to me, pigeon," he whispered. The man who approached him in Potomac Park was FBI and worked in the Hoover Building. His carriage was stiff and herky-jerky, like that of so many government functionaries. There was no confident G-man swagger. The Wolf had been warned that he couldn't buy a useful agent and that he couldn't trust the information if he did, but he hadn't believed that. Money always bought things, and it always bought people, especially if they had been passed over for promotions and raises. This was as true in America as it had been in Russia. If anything, it was more true here, where cynicism and bitterness were becoming the national pastimes. "So, is anybody talking about me up on the fifth floor of the Hoover?" he asked. I don't want to meet like this. Next time you run an ad in the Washington Times." The Wolf smiled, but then he jabbed a finger into the federal agent's jaw. "I asked you a question. Is anybody talking about me?" The agent shook his head. "Not yet, but they will. They've connected the murdered couple on Long Island to Atlanta and to the King of Prussia Mall." The Wolf nodded. "Of course they have. I understand that these people of yours aren't stupid. They're just very limited." "Don't underestimate them," the agent warned. "The Bureau is changing. They're going to come after you with everything they have."
"It won't be enough," said the Wolf. "And besides, maybe I'll come after them with everything I have. I'll huff and I'll puff and I'll blow their house down."
Chapter 54.
The next night I got home before 6 o'clock. I had a sit-down dinner with Nana and the kids, who were surprised but clearly thrilled that I was home so early. The telephone rang toward the end of the meal. I didn't want to answer it. Maybe somebody else had been grabbed, but I didn't want to deal with it. Not tonight.
I'll get it, said Damon. It's probably for me. Some girlfriend.
He snatched the ringing telephone off the kitchen wall, flipped it from one hand to the other.
You wish it was a girl, taunted Janny from the table. Dinner time. It's probably somebody selling MCI or a bank loan. They always call it dinner.
Then Damon was pointing at me, and he wasn't smiling. He didn't look so good either, as if he'd suddenly gotten a little sick to his stomach.
Dad, he said in a low voice, it's for you.
I got up from the table and took the phone from him. You okay? I asked.
It's Ms. Johnson, Damon whispered.
My throat felt constricted as I took the receiver. Now I was the one who felt a little sick, but also confused. Hello? This is Alex, I said.
It's Christine, Alex. I'm in Washington, for a few days. I'd like to see little Alex while I'm here, she said,
sounding as if it were a prepared speech. I felt my face flush.
Why are you calling here? Why now?
I wanted to say, but didn't. Do you want to come over tonight? It's a little late, but we could keep him up. She hesitated.
Actually, I was thinking about tomorrow. Maybe around 8:30, 8:45 in the morning. Would that be all right?
I said, that would be fine, Christine. I'll be here.
Oh, she said, then fumbled for words a little. You don't have to stay home for me. I heard you were working for the FBI.
My stomach clenched. Christine Johnson and I had split up over a year ago, mainly because of the nature of the murder cases I worked. She had actually been abducted because of my work. We finally found her in a shack in a remote area of Jamaica. Alex was born there. I hadn't known Christine was pregnant at the time. We were never the same after that. I felt it was my fault. Then she'd moved to Seattle. It had been Christine's idea that Alex stay with me. She'd been seeing a psychiatrist and said she wasn't emotionally fit to be a mother. Now she was in D.C. for a few days. What brings you back to Washington? I finally asked.
I wanted to see our son, she said, her voice going very soft. And some friends of mine.
I remembered how much I had loved her, and probably still did on some level, but I was resigned to the fact that we wouldn't be together. Christine couldn't stand my life as a cop, and I couldn't seem to give it up.
All right, well, I'll be over at around 8:30 tomorrow, she said.
I'll be here, I said.
Chapter 55
8:30, on the button. A shiny silver Taurus, a rental car from Hertz, pulled up in front of our house on Fifth Street. Christine Johnson got out, and though she looked a little severe with her hair pulled back in a tight bun, I had to admit that she was a beautiful woman. Tall and slender, with distinct, sculpted features that I couldn't make myself forget. Seeing her again made my heart catch in spite of what had happened between us. I was edgy, but also tired. Why was that? I wondered how much energy I'd lost in the past year and a half. A doctor friend from Johns Hopkins has a serious theory that our lifelines are written on the palms of our hands. He swears he can chart stress, illnesses, general health. I visited him a few weeks ago, and Bernie Stringer said I was in excellent physical shape, but that my lifelines had taken a beating in the last year. That was partly because of Christine, our relationship, and the breakup. I was standing behind the protective screen of the front door with Alex in my arms. I stepped outside as Christine approached the house. She was wearing heels and a dark blue suit. Say hi, I said to Alex, and waved one of his arms at his mother. It was so strange, so completely unnerving to see Christine like this again. We had such a complicated history. Much of it was good, but what was bad was very bad. Her husband had been killed in her house during a case I was working on. I had nearly been responsible for her death. Now we were living thousands of miles apart. Why was she in D.C. again? To see little Alex, of course. But what else had brought her? "Hello, Alex," she said, and smiled. And for a dizzying instant, it was as if nothing had changed between us. I remembered the first time I had seen her, when she was still the principal at the Sojourner Truth School. She'd taken my breath away. Unfortunately, I guess, she still did. Christine knelt at the foot of the stairs and spread her arms. "Hi, you handsome guy," she said to little Alex. I set him down and let him decide what to do next. He looked up at me and laughed. Then he chose Christine's beckoning smile, chose her warmth and charm, and went right into her arms. "Hello, baby," she whispered. "I missed you so much. You've grown so big." Christine hadn't brought a gift, no bribes, and I liked that. It was just her, no tricks or gimmicks. But that was enough. In seconds, Alex was laughing and talking up a storm. They looked good together, mother and son. "I'll be inside," I said, after I watched them for a moment. "Come in when you want. There's fresh coffee. Nana's. Breakfast, if you haven't eaten." Christine looked up at me and she smiled again. She looked so happy holding the boy, our small son. "We're fine for the moment," she said. "Thank you. I'll come in for coffee. Of course I will." Of course. Christine had always been so sure about everything, and she hadn't lost any of her confidence. I stepped back inside and nearly bumped into Nana, who was watching from just beyond the screen door. "Oh, Alex," she whispered, and she didn't have to say any more than that. I felt as if a knife had been plunged into my heart. It was the first twist, and just the first of many. I shut the front door and left them to have their private time. Christine brought the baby inside after a while, and we all sat in the kitchen and drank coffee, and she watched Alex with his bottle of apple juice. She talked about her life out in Seattle, mostly about work at a school out there, nothing too personal or revealing. I knew she had to be nervous and stressed, but I never saw it. Then Christine showed the kind of warmth that could melt a heart. She was looking at little Alex. "What a sweetheart he is," she said. "What a sweet, darling little boy. Oh, Alex, my little Alex, how I missed you. You have no idea."
Chapter 56.
Christine Johnson in D.C. again. Why had she come back now? What did she want with us? The questions throbbed in my head and also deep inside my heart. They made me afraid, even before I had a clear idea what to fear. Of course I had a suspicion. Christine had changed her mind about little Alex. That was it. Had to be. Why else would she be here? She certainly hadn't come back to see me. Or had she? I was still on I-95, but just minutes away from Quantico, when Monty Donnelly got through to me on my cell. Miles Davis played on the radio in the car. I'd been trying to chill before I got to work. "You're late again," she said. And though I knew it was a joke, it still cut me some. "I know, I know. I was out partying last night. You know how it is." Monty got right to it. "Alex, did you know they grabbed a couple more suspects last night?" Them again. I was so surprised that I didn't answer Monty right away. I hadn't been told anything about a bust. "I guess not," Monty answered her own question. "It took place in Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania, Joe Namath's hometown. Two unsubs in their 40s ran an adult bookstore, sort of named after the town. The press got a hold of it a few minutes ago. Did they find any of the missing women? I asked Monty.
Don't think so. It's not in the news reports. Nobody seems to know for sure here.
I didn't understand. Do you know how long they were under surveillance? Forget it, Monty. I'm getting off 95 right now. I'm almost there. I'll see you in a couple of minutes.
Sorry to ruin your day so early, she said.
It was already ruined, I muttered. We worked straight through the day, but at 7, we still didn't have very good answers to several questions about the takedown in Pennsylvania. I knew a few things, mostly unimportant details, and it was frustrating. The two men had criminal records for selling pornography. Agents from the field office in Philly had gotten a tip that the two of them were involved in a kidnapping scheme. It was unclear who in the FBI's chain of command knew about the suspects, but there seemed to have been an internal communication breakdown of the sort I'd been hearing about for years before I arrived at Quantico. I talked with Monty a couple of times during the day, but my buddy Ned Mahoney never called me about the bust. Burns' office didn't try to contact me either. I was shook. For one thing, there were reporters out in the parking lot at Quantico. I could see a USA Today van and a CNN truck from my window. Very strange day. Odd and unsettling. Late in the afternoon, I found myself thinking about Christine Johnson's visit to the house. I kept playing back the scene of her holding the baby, playing with Alex. I wondered if I could believe that she'd come to D.C. just to see him and a few of her old friends. It made my heart ache to think about losing the big boy, as I always called him. The big boy. What a joy he was to me, and to the kids, and to Nana Mama. What an unbearable loss it would be. I just couldn't imagine it. Nor could I imagine being Christine and not wanting him back. Before I left for the night, I forced myself to pick up the phone and make a call that I was dreading. Thinking about little Alex made me remember the promise I'd made. Judge Brendan Connolly answered after a few rings. It's Alex Cross, I said. Just wanted to check in with you. Tell you about the news stories you've been seeing today. Judge Connolly asked me if his wife had been found. If there was any news about Lizzie. They didn't find her yet. I don't think those two men were involved with your wife. We're still very hopeful that we'll find her. He began to mutter words that I couldn't make out. After listening to him for a few seconds, trying to make sense of it, I told him I'd keep him informed. If someone informed me. After the difficult phone call, I just sat at my desk. Suddenly, I realized I'd forgotten something else. My class had graduated today. We were officially agents. The others in my class had gotten their credentials or creds as well as their assignments. Right now, cake and punch were being served in the lobby of the Hall of Honor. I didn't bother to go to the party. Somehow it seemed inappropriate to attend. I went home instead.
Chapter 57.
How much time did she have left now? A day? Hours? It almost didn't matter, did it? Lizzie Connolly was learning to accept life as it came. She was learning who she was inside and how to keep herself in balance. Except, of course, when she was frightened out of her mind. Lizzie called them her swimming dreams. She had been an avid swimmer ever since she was 4 years old. The repetition of stroke after stroke, kick after kick, could always put her in another place and time, on autopilot, let her escape. So that was what she was doing now in the closet slash room where she was being kept. Swimming. Escaping. Reach. Slightly cupped hand. S-figure with her arms. Pull at the top. Grab the water. Tip through to the belly button. Then down through the bottom of her swimsuit. Swoosh. Swoosh. Kick. Kick. Feeling hot inside. But the water was cooling. Refreshing. Invigorating. Feeling empowered because she was feeling stronger. She had been thinking about escape for much of the day, or what she thought of as a day, anyway. Now she began to get serious about other things. She reviewed what she knew about this place, the closet, and the vicious, horrifying man who kept her, the wolf. That was what the bastard called himself. Why the wolf? She was somewhere in a city. She was almost sure the city was in the south, and fairly large, lots of money in the surrounding area. Maybe it was Florida. But she didn't know why she thought that. Maybe she had overheard something, and it had only registered in her unconscious. She definitely heard voices in the house when there had been large parties or, occasionally, smaller get-togethers. She believed that her vermin captor lived alone. Who could possibly live with such a horrible monster? No woman could. She knew some of his pathetic habits by heart. He usually turned on the TV when he came home, sometimes ESPN, but more often CNN. He watched the news constantly. He also liked detective shows such as Law and Order, CSI, Homicide. The TV was always on late into the night. He was physically large and strong, and he was a sadist, but also careful about not hurting her badly. Not so far, anyway. Which meant, what did it mean? That he planned to keep her around for a while longer? If Lizzie Connolly could stand it here for another minute, if she didn't flip out and make him so angry that he'd snap her neck as he threatened to several times a day, I'll snap your little neck, like this.
You don't believe me? You should believe me, Elizabeth.
He always called her Elizabeth, not Lizzie. He told her that Lizzie wasn't a beautiful enough name for her.
I'll break your fucking neck, Elizabeth.
He knew who she was and quite a bit about her, and also about Brendan, Bridget, Mary, Gwynnie. He promised that if she made him angry, he'd not only hurt her, but he'd do the same to her family.
I'll go to Atlanta. I'll do it for kicks, just for fun. I live for that kind of thing. I could murder your whole family, Elizabeth.
He was desiring her more and more. She could certainly tell when a man got like that. So she did have some control over him, didn't she? How about that? So, fuck you too, buddy. Sometimes he would leave her binds slightly looser and even give her free time to walk around in the house. Tied up, of course, on a kind of chain leash that he would hold in his hands. It was so demeaning. He told her that he knew she'd be thinking that he was getting kinder and gentler, but not to get any stupid ideas. Well, what the hell else could she do except get ideas? There was nothing for her to do all day, in the dark, by herself. She was... The closet door swung open violently. Then it slammed against the wall outside. The wolf screamed in Lizzie's face.
You were thinking about me, weren't you? You're starting to get obsessive, Elizabeth. I'm in your thoughts all the time.
Damn it. He was right about that.
You're even glad for the company. You miss me, don't you?
But he had that wrong. Dead wrong. Lizzie hated the wolf so much that she contemplated the unthinkable. She could kill him. Maybe that day would come. Imagine that, she thought. God, that is what I want to do. Kill the wolf myself. That would be the greatest escape of all.
Chapter 58.
That same night, the wolf had a meeting with two professional hockey players at Caesars in Atlantic City, New Jersey. The suite where he stayed had gold foil wallpaper everywhere, windows facing the Atlantic, and a hot tub in the living room. Out of respect for his guests, who were big stars, he wore an expensive chalk-stripe Prada suit. His contact happened to be a wealthy cable TV operator who arrived at the Nero suite with the hockey players Alexei Dobushkin and Ilya Tyaptev in tow. Both were members of the Philadelphia Flyers. They were top defensemen who were considered to be tough guys because they were big men who moved quickly and could do a lot of damage. The Wolf didn't believe the hockey players were that tough, but he was a huge fan of the game.
I love American-style hockey, he said as he welcomed them with a broad smile and a hand extended.
Alexei and Ilya nodded his way, but neither of the hockey players shook his hand. The Wolf was offended, but he didn't reveal his feelings. He smiled some more and figured that the hockey players were too stupid to understand who he was. Too many wooden sticks to the skull.
"Drinks, anyone?" he asked his guests. "Stolichnaya? Whatever you like."
"I'll pass," said the cable operator, who seemed incredibly self-important, but a lot of Americans were that way.
"Нет,"
Ilya said with disinterest, as if his host were a hotel barman or a waiter. The hockey player was 22 years old, born in Voskresensk, Russia. He was 6'5", with close-cropped hair, stubble not quite amounting to a beard, and a block of a head sitting on an enormous neck.
"I don't drink stoli," said Alexei, who, like Ilya, wore a black leather jacket with a dark turtleneck underneath. "Maybe you have absolute, or some Bombay gin?"
"Of course," the wolf nodded cordially. He walked to the suite's mirrored wet bar, where he made the drinks and decided what to do next. He was starting to enjoy this. It was different. No one here was afraid of him. He plopped down on the pillowed couch between Ilya and Alexei. He looked back and forth into their faces, smiling broadly again.
"You've been away from Russia for a long time, no? Maybe too long," he said. "Do you drink Bombay gin? You forget your manners?"
"We hear you're a real tough man," said Alexei, who was in his early 30s and obviously lifted weights, a lot of weights, and often. He was around 6 feet and over 220 pounds.
"No, not really," said the wolf. "I am just another American businessman these days. Nothing very special, not tough anymore. So I was wondering, do we have a deal for the game with Montreal?"
Alexei looked over at the cable guy.
"Tell him," he said.
"Alexei and Ilya are looking for a little more action than what we originally talked about," he said. "You understand what I'm saying? Action?"
"Ah," said the wolf and grinned broadly. "I love action," he said to the businessman. "I love shalit, too. Means mischief in my country. Shalit."
He was up off the couch faster than anyone would have thought possible. He pulled a small lead pipe from beneath a couch cushion and cracked it across Alexei Dubushkin's cheek. Then he swung it off the bridge of Ilya Tyaptyev's nose. The two hockey stars were bleeding like stuck pigs in seconds. Then, and only then, did the wolf take out his gun. He held it between the eyes of the cable owner.
"You know, they're not such tough guys as I thought. I can tell about these things in a few seconds," he said. "Now, down to business. One of the two big bears will allow a score by Montreal in the first period. The other will miss a play for a score in the second. Do you understand? The Flyers will lose the game in which they're favored. Understood? If for any reason this doesn't happen, then everybody dies. Now let yourselves out. I look forward to the game. As I said, I love American-style hockey."
The wolf began to laugh as the big hockey star stumbled out of the Nero suite.
"Nice meeting you, Ilya, Alexei," he said as the door closed. "Break a leg."
Chapter 59.
A huge task force meeting was held in the Psyox suite on the fifth floor of the Hoover Building, which was considered sacred ground in the Bureau. Psyox is the Strategic Information Operations Center, and the central suite was where most of the really important powwows were held, from Waco to September 11th. I had been invited, and I wondered whom I had to thank for it. I arrived at around 9 and was brought in by an agent who manned the front desk. I saw that the Psyox suite consisted of 4 rooms, 3 of which were filled with state-of-the-art workstations, probably for researchers and analysts. I was led into a large conference room. The focal point was a long glass and metal table. On the walls were clocks set to different time zones, several maps, and half a dozen TV monitors. A dozen or so agents were already inside the room, but it was quiet. Stacy Pollock, the head of PSYOC, finally arrived and the doors were shut. Pollock introduced the agents who were present, as well as 2 visitors from the CIA. She had a reputation inside the Bureau for being a no-nonsense administrator who didn't suffer fools and who got results. She was 31 years old, and Burns loved her. The TV monitors on the wall told the latest story. Live-action film was up and running on the major networks. Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania, said the super. That's old news. We have a new problem, announced Pollock from the front of the room. We're not here because of the screw-up at Beaver Falls. This is internal, so it's worse. Folks, we think we've learned the name of the person responsible for the leaks out of Quantico. Then Pollock looked right at me. A reporter at the Washington Post denies it, but why wouldn't he? She continued. The leaks come from a crime analyst named Monty Donnelly. You're working with her, aren't you, Dr. Cross? Suddenly, the conference room seemed very small and constricting. Everyone had turned toward me. Is this why I'm here? I asked. No, said Pollock. You're here because you're experienced with sexual obsession cases. You've been involved with more of them than anyone else in the room. But that isn't my question. I thought carefully before I answered. This isn't a sexual obsession case, I told Pollock. And Monty Donnelly isn't the leak. I'd like you to explain both of those statements. Pollock challenged me immediately. Please, go ahead. I'm listening with great interest. I'll do my best, I said. The abductors, the group or ring behind the kidnappings, are in this for the money. I don't see any other explanation for their actions. The slain Russian couple on Long Island is a key. I don't think we should be looking at past sex offenders as our focus. The question should be, who has the resources and expertise to abduct men and women for a price, and probably a very large price? Who has experience in this area? Monty Donnelly knows that, and she's an excellent analyst. She's not the leak to the Post. What would she have to gain? Stacy Pollock looked down and shuffled some of her papers. She didn't comment on anything I'd said. Let's move on, she said. The meeting resumed without any further discussion of Monty and the charges against her. Instead, there was a lengthy discussion of the Red Mafia, including new information that the couple murdered on Long Island definitely had connections to Russian gangsters. There were also rumors of a possible mob war about to break out on the East Coast, involving the Italians and the Russians. After the larger meeting, we broke off into smaller groups. A few agents took workstations. Stacy Pollock pulled me aside. Listen, I wasn't accusing you of anything, she said. I wasn't suggesting that you're involved in the leaks, Alex. So who accused Monty? I asked. She seemed surprised by the question. I won't tell you that. Nothing is official yet. What do you mean, nothing is official yet? I asked. No action has been taken against Ms. Donnelly. We will probably pull her off this investigation, though. That's all I have to say on the subject for now. You can go back to Quantico. I guess I'd been dismissed.
Chapter 60.
I called Monty as soon as I could and told her what had happened. She got furious, as she should have. But then Monty took hold of herself. All right, so now you know. I'm not as controlled as I look, she said. Well, fuck them. I didn't leak anything to the Washington Press, Alex. That's absurd. Who would I tell? Our paper boy? I know you didn't, I said. Listen, I have to stop at Quantico. Then how about I take you and the boys for a quick meal tonight? Cheap, I added, and she managed to sniffle out a laugh. All right. I know a place. It's called the Command Post Pub. We'll meet you. The boys like it there a lot. You'll see why. Monty told me how to get to the pub, which was close to Quantico on Potomac Avenue. After I made a stop at my temporary office at Club Fed, I drove over to meet her and her two boys. Matt and Will were just 11 and 12. They were big dogs, though, like their father. Both were already close to 6 feet. Mom says you're okay, said Matt, as he shook hands with me. She said the same about you and Will, I told him. Everybody at the table laughed. Then we ordered guilty pleasures, burgers, chicken wings, cheese fries, which Monty figured she deserved after her ordeal. Her sons were well-mannered and easy to be with, and that told me a lot about Monty. The pub was an interesting choice. It was cluttered with Marine Corps memorabilia, including officers' flags, photos, and a couple of tables with machine gun rounds in them. Monty said that Tom Clancy had mentioned the bar in Patriot Games, but in the novel he said there was a picture of George Patton on the wall, which upset the bar's regulars, especially since Clancy had made a career out of being in the know. The command post was a Marines bar, not Army. When we were leaving, Monty took me aside. A few Marines were going in and out. They gawked a little at us.
"Thank you. Thank you, Alex. This means a lot to me," she said. "I know denials don't mean a damn thing, but I did not leak information to the Washington Post, or to Rush Limbaugh, or O'Reilly either, or anyone fucking else. Never happened, never will. I'm true blue to the end, which apparently could be near."
"That's what I told them at the Hoover Building," I said. "The true blue part." Monty rose on her toes and kissed me on the cheek.
"I owe you big time, mister. You should also know you're impressing the hell out of me. Even Matt and Will seemed neutral to positive, and you're one of the enemy to them. Grown-ups."
"Keep working the case," I told her. "You have exactly the right attitude."
Monty looked puzzled, but then she got it. "Oh, yeah, I do, don't I? Fuck them."
"It's the Russians," I said, before I left her at the door of the command post. "It has to be. We've got that much right."
Chapter 61.
Two people very much in love. Often a beautiful thing to watch. But not in this case. Not on this starry night in the hills of central Massachusetts. The devoted lovers' names were Vince Petrillo and Francis Deegan, and they were juniors at Holy Cross College in Worcester, where they had been inseparable since their first week as freshmen. They'd met in the Mullady dorm on Easy Street and had rarely been apart since. They'd even worked at the same fish restaurant the past two summers in Provincetown. When they graduated, they planned to be married, then do the grand tour through Europe. Holy Cross was a Jesuit school that, justly or unjustly, had some reputation for being homophobic. Offending students could be suspended or even expelled under the breach of peace rule, which forbade conduct which is lewd or indecent. The Catholic Church did not actually condemn temptation toward members of the same sex, but homosexual acts were often considered intrinsically perverted and seen as constituting a grave moral disorder. Because the Jesuits could be hard on homosexual relationships, among the students anyway, Vince and Francis kept theirs as private and secret as they could. In recent months, though, they had started to figure their relationship probably wasn't a very big deal, especially given the scandals among the Catholic clergy. The campus arboretum at Holy Cross had long been a hangout for students who wanted to be alone and those who had romantic intentions. The garden area boasted over 100 different kinds of trees and shrubs and overlooked downtown Worcester. Wormtown, as it was sometimes called by students. That night, Vince and Francis, dressed in athletic shorts, T-shirts, and matching purple and white baseball caps, strolled down Easy Street to a brick patio and lawn area known as Wheeler Beach. It was crowded, so they continued on to find a quiet spot in the arboretum. There, they lay on a blanket under a nearly full moon and a sky studded with stars. They held hands and talked about the poetry of W.B. Yeats, whom Francis adored, and Vince, a pre-med student, tolerated as best he could. The two men were an unusual couple physically. Vince was just over 5'7" and weighed 180. Most of it was solid due to his obsessive weightlifting at the gym, but it was obvious he had to work hard at it. He had curly black hair that framed a soft, almost angelic face that wasn't too much different from his baby pictures, one of which his lover carried in his wallet. Francis could make either sex drool, and that was Vince's private joke when they were among co-eds. "Drool, fools." Francis was 6'1", without an ounce of fat. His white blonde hair was cut in the same style he had adopted as a sophomore at Christian Brothers Academy in New Jersey. He adored Vince with all his heart, and Vince worshipped him. They came for Francis, of course. He had been scouted and purchased.
Chapter 62.
The three burly men were dressed in loose jeans, work boots, and dark windbreakers. They were hoodlums. In Russian, they were called baklani, or banditi. Scary demons wherever you met up with them. Monsters from Moscow let loose in America by the wolf. They parked a black Pontiac Grand Prix on the street, then climbed the hill to the main campus at Holy Cross. One of them was short of breath and complained in Russian about the steepness of the hill. "Quiet, asshole," said group leader Maxim, who liked to call himself a personal friend of the wolf's, though of course he wasn't. No Pakan had real friends, but especially not the wolf. He had only enemies and almost never met those who worked for him. Even in Russia, he had been known as an invisible or mystery man. Here in the U.S., virtually no one knew him by sight. The three thugs watched the college students on the blanket as they held hands, then kissed and fondled. "Kissed like girls," said one of the Russian men with a nasty laugh. "Not like any girls I ever kiss." The three of them laughed and shook their heads in disgust. Then the hulking leader of the team strode forward, moving very fast given his weight and size. He silently pointed at Francis, and the two other men pulled the boy away from Vince. "Hey, what the hell is this?" Francis started to yell. He was stopped by a wide strip of electrical tape pressed over his mouth, cutting off all sound.
"Now you can scream," said one of the smirking hoods.
"Scream like a girl, but nobody hears you anymore."
They worked together quickly. While one thug wrapped more black tape around Francis's ankles, the other bound his wrists tightly behind his back. Then he was stuffed inside a large duffel bag, the sort used to carry athletic equipment such as baseball bats or basketballs. The leader, meanwhile, took out a thin, very sharp stiletto knife. He slit the heavy-set boy's throat, just as he used to kill pigs and goats back in his home country. Vince hadn't been purchased, and he had seen the abduction team. Unlike the couple, these men would never play their own little games or betray the wolf or disappoint him. There would be no more mistakes. The wolf had been explicit on that, clear in a dangerous way that only he could be.
"Take the pretty boy, quickly," said the leader of the team as they hurried back to their car.
They tossed the bulging bag into the trunk of the Pontiac and got out of town. The job was perfect.
Chapter 63.
Here was the deal as Francis saw it now, as he tried to be calm and logical about it. Nothing that had happened to him could possibly have happened. He couldn't have been abducted a few hours ago from the campus of Holy Cross by three absolutely terrifying men. It just couldn't have happened. Nor could he have been transported in the trunk of a car for 4, maybe 5 hours to God only knew where. Most important, Vince couldn't be dead. That cruel and heartless piece of shit couldn't have slit Vince's throat back at the college. It hadn't happened. So all this had to be an impossibly bad dream. A nightmare of the sort that Francis Deegan hadn't experienced since he was maybe 3 or 4 years old. And this man standing before him now, this absurd caricature with curly tufts of white blonde hair around the side of his balding head, dressed in a tight black leather bodysuit, well, he couldn't be real either. No way. "I'm very angry at you. I'm good and pissed," Mr. Potter yelled right in Francis's face. "Why did you leave me?" he screeched. "Why? Tell me why. You must never leave me again. I get very scared without you, and you know that. You know how I am. That was thoughtless of you, Ronald." Francis had already tried reasoning with the madman. Potter, he called himself. And no,